Hello and welcome back to the history of video games. My name is Ben, and I'm joined by the one and only Wes. How are you doing today, Wes?
I'm doing great today, Ben. The weather's lovely. What more can you ask for? Have time to play video games later. Ugh, it's a beautiful thing. How are you doing?
Oh, definitely. I'm doing good, man. I've been very busy, been playing lots of shows, but have still found some time for some games. Been up late some nights I probably shouldn't have been, but
that's what you got to do sometime, you know? So do you have anything in the backlog? Are you up to current? What do you want to talk about today?
Actually, I beat two games this week, so hopefully the backlog is going to give me a little bit more there, because I was pretty close to catching up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've got a couple games to talk about. I think the one I need to talk about next is one that I beat on the Unity launcher, because I always forget about those. Like, even when we do end of the year stuff, like for the end of the year games for last year, I completely forgot that I played Max Payne because it wasn't in Steam.
Oh, you mean Ubisoft launcher?
That was a great game. That one was on the Rockstar launcher, but for this game I'm going to be talking about this week, it was on the Ubisoft launcher.
Okay.
But I just forget about the games.
Yeah,
anyway,
same.
I played through Rainbow Six Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
It's the next game in the Rainbow Six line. I've been playing a lot of them over the years because I have this like Tom Clancy pack that I bought a while ago. But I'm finally at Rainbow Six Vegas, and this is one that I was looking forward to a lot because I know you had played this one, and
yes,
you were kind of hyping it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. It's really good. I liked it a lot, but it's really different than everything else that has come before it in the Rainbow Six franchise. So I definitely have a lot of opinions on it. To kind of describe the gameplay a little bit, it kind of plays a little bit like a Call of Duty game. That's not at all what old Rainbow Six was.
Right.
I mean, old Rainbow Six, you have like a team of like eight people. The time to kill is like milliseconds. So if you make one wrong move, you're dead and possibly your whole squad's dead. So it was very, very quick. You had to kind of memorize the positions of the enemies. You had to pre-plan your route. You had to like coordinate strikes to go into like one room from multiple angles at the same time. Super tactical. I really loved it. Lots of planning, lots of kind of figuring out each map and scenario and playing it multiple times. But that's how it had always been. For Rainbow Six Vegas, they went a completely different direction. Now, instead of controlling like a team of eight people, it's you and two other people, and there is no pre-planning. The time to kill is also a lot longer, meaning that you can take multiple shots, and then like there's a weird screen kind of fades out mechanic where if you just don't get hit for a while, you'll regain all of your health, which was definitely not in the old games.
Right.
I mean, if you got hit in the old games, if you survived, you were just at half health, you know? So that's way different. The gameplay was a lot more Call of Duty-esque, you know? Like, I don't know, like, you could kind of just run into the combats and not really feel like, unless there's like five guys after you, you'll be fine. There was critical hits and headshots that the enemies can do to you, which will one-shot you. So you can die quick in Rainbow Six Vegas, but I don't think the gameplay really was trying to make you like always have to be behind corners or playing slowly. It's a lot more fast paced and arcadey. So very, very different. There is some elements of the old games in there. So for example, like I said, you have two allies with you at all time and you can command them around. They can breach doors. They can like be positioned in certain areas to kind of flank the enemy or something maybe. They kind of play a little bit like Republic Commando.
When you were saying that. Yeah, that was what popped in my mind.
I think Republic Commando, you can do a little bit more with your companions. They definitely have a lot better personalities in Republic Commando than they do here. But it's a little bit of that, you know? So it's not exactly like Call of Duty. And those little tidbits from the old games were noticeable. And I liked it, you know, better than just a straight up Call of Duty game. Which I double checked the timeline, by the way. Rainbow Six 3, which is the last one I played, I think came out in 2003. Call of Duty also came out in 2003. And then this game came out in 2006. So,
pretty much
as soon as Call of Duty came out, they started working on this one. So, pretty clear, you know, different direction that they went in on this one. And, you know, the old formula was stale. I definitely said in Rainbow Six 3 that I was hoping they would do more with it, especially the story, because most all the Rainbow Six games, the story is just text dumps, you know, and that's pretty much all it was. But in Rainbow Six Vegas, the story is way better because, like, the missions aren't so level feeling. You can kind of move from one area to the next and have it be a little bit more cohesive. A lot larger levels, right? A lot more walking around. And there was a lot of in-game cutscenes, which they didn't have before. I felt the story itself was well written, and I kind of liked the whole game kind of takes place over the course of like one night in Vegas, and you kind of go from casino to casino. Taking out terrorists. And there's something about that, like, you know, whole story happens in one night kind of vibe that I really like. You know, it lets you get into the details and get to know these characters really well in a short amount of time. So I really like the story right up until the very end, where the ending of this game is pretty much like bad guy gets away and says, "You'll have to catch me later," and then the credits roll. You know, definitely just like sequel bait. You know? So there's not really an ending. It feels definitely like the part one of two. So they must have known they were going to do a two, which they did do. So right up until the end, I thought it was really well told, a lot better than the other games. So yeah, it's just very different, right? I mean, I really liked the gameplay of the old games, and it's a little sad that it's clearly gone now. But at the same time, the new game's really good. The gun gameplay is still really good. The story was way better. The graphics are actually really good. There was certain like in-game cutscene flyovers of the Las Vegas skyline at night with it lit up that I was like, wow, that looks really good. And like, this is a 20-year-old game or something. But I thought, like, wow, they really stepped up the graphics here. The gameplay itself, a little hard, I'd say. Or not hard, but like annoying, because you can get headshot in one shot. Right. Otherwise, you're like a bullet sponge. So it's just like frustrating at times. But overall, it was really good. Maybe a little short. I think it took me maybe 6 to 8 hours to beat it. But I really enjoyed it. Like, it was a great game. I definitely would probably have preferred that over like a traditional Call of Duty game. So I'm glad they had some semblance of tacticalness in there. But, you know, it wasn't like it was, and that's kind of sad. So I don't know. I don't know how to feel. I feel like it's a really great game, but it's not very Rainbow Six-y to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, I don't know for sure if they do any more Rainbow Six games, like not part of the little like Vegas sub series that are more tactical, because the Vegas ones are really the only ones I ever played. But very interesting. Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm glad you liked it for the most part. It's funny because that's my introduction to the series. So, you know, so I didn't know the tactical aspects of it so much, other than the fact that you could like order people on corners or whatever. And I just thought the gunplay was really fun. And I think in the second game, which I played a lot in multiplayer, you can unlock outfits and like customize your character, which I thought was fun. But
nice. Yeah. Well, I'm definitely still looking forward to the series. It is interesting, like, I think the gunplay was great on it. It's kind of weird because all the guns were unlocked from the very beginning, which is how it was in the old Rainbow Six games as well. But it also kind of felt like none of the guns were that different, because they all had to be equally balanced to be ready to go in level one, almost, you know?
Right, yeah.
So it was a little bit mixed, but yeah, I mean, I did really like it. So I'm definitely looking forward to more. I hope, if it not Rainbow Six, there's other games out there that kind of had that old playing style too, because there's something so satisfying about having 8 guys come in through 3 doorways simultaneously and take out, you know, a bunch of terrorists that were holding a hostage,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's so fun. But nothing like that really happened in Rainbow Six Vegas. So, I don't know. Hopefully they can strike that balance, but
yeah, we'll have to see.
Just really interesting to see the changes that they made.
And over just probably a few short years too, like 3 years or whatever Lisa said. That's kind of crazy. Cool.
All right, but that's what I've been up to. What have you been up to, Wes? Now that you're done Witcher, right?
Yes, yeah, and my video game trajectory took an unexpected turn. Wasn't sure what I wanted to play next, but I had previously, a couple months ago, after playing Morrowind, wanted to start an Oblivion campaign. That got put on hold for Witcher, and then suddenly when I'm thinking about what game to play, Bethesda Shadow drops the Oblivion remaster. So
yeah,
I got sidetracked. I waited about 4 days before I said, no, I think I am going to buy it. I had started playing the original again. And I'm like, the original is still good. I don't need to buy the remaster. But then the more I looked at it and I was like, I've already done a full playthrough of Oblivion. If I want to play it again, maybe it's a good way to go. So I bought it. I took the plunge, bought the Oblivion remaster, and I gotta say, it is really good so far. It is very much a remaster and not a remake. They just made it look really, really good, but all the voice acting is the same, I think, which makes a lot of sense, especially because they had big names like Patrick Stewart and Sean Bean voicing characters in the game. They probably couldn't get them to do that again. And also, like, the mini games, the leveling, like all of the core gameplay is exactly the same. So it still has kind of the old feel of, like, I think speaking of 2006, I think that might be when Oblivion came out originally. It still has that old feel of like an old school Bethesda RPG with like these weird little mini games and the lock picking and all that kind of stuff. The leveling, which is a little bit more in depth, I feel like, or well, it's different than Skyrim, but I like the Oblivion leveling system. Morrowind's better, in my opinion, but still. So I've been loving it. It's got a bunch of the classic Bethesda jank. Even though they updated the textures and facial animations, the faces do even more bizarre, weird stuff now as the characters are talking. Like sometimes their eyes will just open really, really huge when they're like yelling at you, and it's goofy. So yeah, that's pretty much been it. What I've been doing recently. I don't have too much to say about it yet because I've only played like 4 or 5 hours, but I think I'm going to stick with it for a bit and maybe do a full playthrough of it.
Okay, nice. Well, I've been seeing a lot of videos on it as well. And I actually have a list of games that I'm planning on like purchasing someday.
Yeah.
And I put it on that list right away.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it does make me wonder, like, I wonder how much time it took them to do that. And like, imagine if they did that for like Rainbow Six Vegas. Like, there's so many old games that they could probably just port over to Unreal and people would be like, this is amazing. This is my childhood. I would definitely want this. I don't know. Seems like obvious. Like, why didn't you do that earlier? Now, looking back on this Oblivion remaster, because just seeing how people have like really attached themselves to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, I mean, people of our generation, I feel like Oblivion was a huge one as well. But yeah, I'm sure it's expensive because they hire another studio to do it. But From Software did that with Demon's Souls for the PS5 or whatever, right. I think. So I'd be down to see more people do the like extreme glow up, even though it is kind of just recycling a game. It's like making it fun to play it again and nostalgic, but at the same time, a new experience. It's really cool. I just hope that because they did Oblivion doesn't mean they won't go back and do Morrowind at some point. I love Morrowind. It's like from the era where I feel like they didn't understand yet that RPGs shouldn't be so confusing, but I love how confusing the stats are. And like, it's just a lot of fun.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
All right, but why don't we get back into the history of video games and talking about the 80s, not our 2006 history like we have been talking about. We've got, as we mentioned, for November, tons of new hardware and another new piece of hardware that we're going to talk about today, the Sord M5 computer, and it's Sord spelled S-O-R-D. Sord, the company, was founded in 1970 by a guy named Takeyoshi Shina. Originally, what it did was make software for DEC PDP computers, mainframe computers. Apparently, the name comes from the S and the O in software and the R and the D in hardware. This doesn't make a lot of sense. Slammed together just to show that they made both software and hardware, and so they're Sord. Over the years, in the 70s, though, they did make several microcomputers like the M200 Smart Home Computer and the M100 series of computers. I think we've mentioned a few of them, but none of them have been huge deals. But in 1982, Sord decided to enter the video game computer market, you know, making a computer more geared towards video games with the Sord M5. The computer is going to be mostly popular in Japan, but it does get sold in the UK as well as the CGL M5, And it also gained a very specific following in Czechoslovakia, apparently, because it was one of like the cheaper computers that were available there at the time.
Okay.
The M5, though, it was pretty small compared to a lot of other new computers we've been seeing. Didn't come with a monitor or anything like that, but it was the kind of classic 70s and 80s computer where it's just like a built-in keyboard, and that basically is the computer. It had ports on the back for controllers, and it had a flap on the top that when you flipped it up, there were some instructions on there, but there was also a cartridge port. Interestingly, this computer ran programs using cartridges, which, you know, a lot of computers at this time are switching over to the floppy disks, or, you know, they still have type in stuff as well. But this came with a cartridge to run BASIC on the computer, so something that we don't see all that often, and cartridge games are going to be released for it as well. When it did end up coming to the UK, it cost £195, which apparently was more expensive at the time than some of its direct competitors like the ZX Spectrum or VIC-20. So we'll have to see how it does and how many games we have for it. But Ben, since this is supposedly geared towards gaming, I'm really curious to hear how good it's going to be.
Yeah, well, it's got an interesting spec sheet.
Okay, yeah.
Starting with the CPU, we got a Xilinx Z80. Okay,
classic.
We've seen them all over the place. The Spectrum, as you mentioned, that has a Xilinx Z80 as well. So we know what the Z80 can do. It also has a TMS9918 graphics chip. And this is the same chip that's in the CreativeVision and the ColecoVision and the TI-99.
Okay.
So I think that's probably pretty good. We'll see. We'll see. It has 4 sound channels, so that makes me happy. I'm glad we have some sound channels. The resolution is 256 by 192 pixels. For some comparison, that's the same resolution as the TRS-80 Coco. And it's also the same resolution as the CreativeVision. I would say it's okay, but it's pretty. It's a lot lower than stuff like the BBC Micro and the Commodore 64. I think its claim to fame, you know, you mentioned it's kind of made for gaming. It can support up to 32 sprites on screen, which is, I think, probably double that of anything else I've really seen. So that's cool. Hopefully that'll mean lots of different figures moving around on the screen. I don't know. It can also support up to 16 colors, which is good, but not great. Something that's really weird, though, it only has 4 kilobytes of RAM, which is terrible. And 16 kilobytes of VRAM, which is a spec that we rarely see ever. So I don't know what that's going to do. And I don't know if this is set up like the Atari 2600, where like cartridges can have their own RAM. I'm assuming they can. Otherwise, this would be terrible.
Right.
But yeah, so I don't know. The RAM seems really, really bad. Apparently, it's one of the things that led to this not having as much software released for it as some might expect. However, the other side of the coin is that the Sword Company was able to get supported or had partnerships with big Japanese developers like Namco and Konami. So there are some really great games for the system made by some really big teams and companies. So, you know, it's definitely a little bit gaming focused, which is good for us. But the specs are, I would say, middling.
Yeah,
I'm a little worried about the RAM. The price point is middle of the road as well. It's more expensive than the Spectrum, but it's a lot cheaper than like the Commodore 64.
Right.
So I don't know. I think it's going to be a bit of a side move in terms of history. There's going to be some good games for it for sure, but it's not going to come up that often. I think it'll come up the same amount as, you know, the Coco does or the Spectrum does. So we'll just have to see. But one thing that is cool and makes it probably worth checking out, regardless of specs, is that it's coming from Japan, which is a kind of a whole different set of developers that we rarely see, especially for home computers. So
yeah.
Hopefully we'll get some new developers and developer teams making different types of games that will be worth checking out. So yeah, definitely one that we're going to be keeping our eyes on.
For sure. We do have some games to talk about for the Sword M5 today, so why don't we take a quick break before we hop into our timeline.
We'll be right back.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Let's hop into our timeline and talk about some Sword M5 games. This launched in November of 1982, where we are right now, so we are going to cover all of the games for the rest of the year. And to start things off, we do have a bunch that were just not super interesting, or we didn't have enough info on them to cover. Listing a few, we have Blackjack, Slot Machine, Bosconian by Takara, the first two were by Sword, Gatang Gatong by Konami, Power Pack by Takara, Super Cobra by Takara, and Tank Battalion by Takara.
I don't know who Takara is, but maybe we'll know soon enough.
They're making lots of games right now, yeah.
They made another one here. This one we wanted to mention on its own because it's a little bit better than the rest. It's Dig Dug, a port of Dig Dug by Takara for the Sword M5 that came out in 1982. This is a fantastic port of Dig Dug, and what really stood out to me was the great music. That's something that I think we're going to be talking about a lot with all the games today. For whatever reason, the Sword M5 has phenomenal music, so we'll definitely play, if not Dig Dug, we'll play one of these for you.
All right, and then we have Galax, which was by Sword, and this was a simple Galaxian port, but it did have some pretty good sound effects, you know, as we've mentioned, great sounds in this, and also it did have the ability to get the double ship, which I feel like a lot of Galaxian ports don't bring that functionality over.
Cool. We also have another Takara game here, Warp Warp. If you remember, we did cover an arcade game called Warp Warp way back in the day. It's such a weird one for them to pick to port over to the new computer, but they did for whatever reason. And it's really well done again and has really great music.
All right. And then the last one that we have for the Sword for today and for all of 1982 is Wonderhole. That's a bit of a strange name, but stick with me. It's by Irem, and it is a new Rally X type game with great music as well. Irem is, you know, a pretty big arcade company, so like Ben was saying at the top, it's pretty cool. We might start to see some big companies making games for this computer.
All right, cool. All right, but that's it for the Sword M5 for 1982. It did come out in November, so there wasn't that much time to make a bunch of new games, even though Takara seemingly made like 10 games.
Right.
But, that's all we have for the Sword M5. There is a lot more games that come out next year, so hopefully we'll talk about it more then. But let's move on to just some other generic kind of computer games here, starting off with Close Assault by Avalon Hill, which came out in November for the Apple II, TRS-80, and Atari 8-bit computers. This is a computer game board game hybrid. It played a hex-based combat board game, and the board looked really cool. But the computer really didn't add much. I think it just like rolled the dice and stuff, you know. But I don't think there was much graphics to the computer game at all. But I thought the board game looked great.
All right. And then we have Pinball Construction Set by Electronic Arts. Oh. EA. Finally, seeing EA in the game. And this Pinball Construction Set was for the Apple II. And it was a game that let you create your own pinball tables and distribute them to your friends. The pinball gameplay was pretty standard, but it actually sold really well, over 250,000 copies.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, Wes, I've been doing a lot of 1983 research, and the amount of companies that have taken a pinball construction set table that they made and tried to sell it as their own product is staggering.
That's hilarious. Well, yeah, I'm sure EA is going to start filing suit for some of those if they didn't already. In
are they already going down that path? This is what set them off, maybe.
All right, but that's going to take us to the first review of the day. I got to take a look at Microsoft Flight Simulator version 1.0 by Sublogic. This is, you know, the original Microsoft Flight Simulator. We previously had looked at FS1 Flight Sim for the Apple II by Sublogic, which was the, you know, precursor. But this is it. This is officially the first Microsoft Flight Sim, so we had to take a look at it. And it is on Windows DOS, and specifically it was made originally for the IBM PC. Or I guess Microsoft DOS. It wasn't Windows DOS at that point. I can't remember.
Yeah, it's just MS-DOS, yeah.
Yeah.
No Windows yet.
No windows. But in 1981, after seeing, I guess, FS1 Flight Sim in 1980, Microsoft reached out to the company and specifically to the president of Sublogic, Bruce Artwick, who programmed the first game and asked if he could program a new flight simulator for IBM PCs. This game got good reviews, it sold well, and recently in 2021, it was added to the World Video Game Hall of Fame. So I got high hopes for this going into it. Reading the manual, which I did not read all of because the manual is 107 pages.
Oh, God.
But just the introduction, at least, the world for this game is apparently 10,000 by 10,000 miles. And it covered the US, Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean with 4 inhabited areas and over 20 airports that you could land at. I will say when you play the game, it might be hard to see all those details, but the details are there, which is great. The game also had weather options like fog or rain or high winds and different times of day from morning to afternoon to a nighttime mode that you could play. And then also had easy or reality flight modes, depending on your skill level. They said they added the easy flight skill level because the weather options made everything harder and they wanted everyone to be able to play it. So very interesting. They're giving some entry level flight skills here. And the game specifically simulates flying a Cessna 182, which apparently at the time was used to train pilots in real life. So they wanted to kind of emulate that sort of plane. But getting into the gameplay now, like I said, 107 pages. I did not read it all, but suffice to say, it is a very nuanced simulation of flying a plane. It goes into tons of detail. I mean, there's all the gauges right there on the screen when you're playing, and you got to pay attention to all of them if you want to fly well. In the main flight simulation mode, there aren't really any goals, though. It's just a flight simulator. You fly around, explore the world, and land or don't land, whatever you feel like doing, while managing, you know, various conditions, if you put in the weather conditions or different time of day and all that stuff. Like FS1 Flight Sim, though, the game has a cockpit perspective where you can monitor all the instruments in front of you while you're flying and see out the front window in a sort of simulated 3D kind of perspective. It almost looks like vector graphics the way they do it, but it's not. And the game also had a dogfighting mode, just like FS1, called British Ace. In that one, it was like you're friendly with everyone until you open fire and then you've officially declared war and all the enemy planes come after you. That's the basic description of the gameplay. I mean, it's flight simulator. I feel like most people know it. It's really realistic simulation of flight. And this is, you know, the first Microsoft iteration of it. So let me get into graphics first. I gave this a 3 out of 10 for graphics. I mean, compared to the first one, we are seeing so much more color. You know, it's not just different colored lines, but we actually have like filled in color for grass, a lot more detail than in FS1. But it is still a computer game and it feels like it's trying to do a lot, so it doesn't look incredible. My favorite part is probably the instruments and gauges. They look a ton better than in FS1. They're very well detailed. All of them have dials and arrows that actually move to indicate what controls you're inputting. There's even like the, I don't know if it's the altimeter or what the right word is for it, but you know, it shows you brown where the ground is and blue where the sky is, and it shows you if your nose pitches below the horizon line and you're headed towards the ground, and that actually like updates in real time. So that's pretty crazy. There's how close you are to the ground to altitude wise, and that has a real time moving thing as well. So it all looks like the interior of a plane cockpit. It's pretty sweet. Things do move kind of slow. You know, it might be sort of like a 5 frames a second, 10 frames a second. I don't know. It's pretty slow, but you can look at it and get a good idea of what's happening if you know the instruments. So I think for people who knew planes, this was probably great visual representation of it. The world itself, like I said, there's a lot more color, so it is much improved. There's different color for grass compared to the water. Everything scales pretty well when you fly close to it, but not perfectly. There were times where you would be flying up to what looked like a skyscraper, and then all of a sudden it would like get distorted and go half underground when you got too close to it and then snap back. So there were some issues. And from what I could see, I played a little bit. I watched a couple of videos, but it was all on the same map. I don't know which airport it was taken off from, but there was only one building on the map, and then everything else was just either green or blue. So it looks good, but there's not that much detail. I think they're still doing good for the time. I wish there was more detail, but overall, considering the gigantic size of the map, it's still pretty impressive. So that's why I landed on the 3 out of 10. Although again, like, the map's that huge, but I don't know if you can fly all the way through it or how that even works. If you have to refuel, it all seemed very confusing to me. Moving on to sounds now, though, I gave this a 1.5 out of 10. There are sounds, which I was happy to hear. That's not a guarantee on these computers, but they just aren't that exciting, unfortunately. And the main sound is the engine of the plane, which is constantly running. It makes sense. You know, I think it's good to have the engine sound, but it's pretty loud. And it definitely gets annoying when that's like the only sound going on, just this constant drone. There are also a few beeps for different warnings you get, like if you're accidentally diving to the ground or anything like that. But none of the sounds were too crazy. There wasn't like an explosion noise for crashing. It just said crash on the screen and then restarted you. All right, but let's move on to gameplay now. I feel like this is kind of the big one for Microsoft Flight Sim. I was a little bit torn on it, though, to be honest. Part of it is that for me, as someone who has little knowledge about planes, I'll be totally honest, I couldn't even get my plane off the ground. I tried a couple times, I adjusted the flaps, I, you know, made sure I was accelerating fast enough, but I was missing something in the 107 pages of the manual. And also, I was having trouble accessing the easy flight mode. But from what I saw, and you know how popular it does end up being, I could absolutely see people having a great time with it, especially if they know about planes, because it is so in-depth and gives you a lot of control. The fact that it's simulating you flying over huge distances is pretty amazing too, even if it does move somewhat slowly. It moves faster than anything like it before, for sure. So I love what it's doing. It's just today, going back and playing it, it's not a ton of fun. To be honest, it's sluggish. It's hard to figure out. Once you get into it, there's no real goals. It's just fly around unless you're doing the dogfight mode. So it's really, really cool. And I love that they're doing this in 82, but I don't know. It wasn't a ton of fun. So I landed on a 3.75 out of 10 for the gameplay. For relevance, though, I had to give this a 9 out of 10. It is the first Microsoft Flight Sim, and it's obviously still a big franchise today. Even though FS1 Flight Sim is the first of this, you know, it's the precursor. It doesn't have the name, and the name's a big part of it. And, you know, the fact that it was contracted by Microsoft. So it's really cool to see in 1982 the exact name of a game that's still around today. Like Ultima, you know, we've seen that already, but that one kind of fades out of existence, and this one's still around. So overall, that left me with a 2.75 out of 10. The sound score does bring the overall rating down quite a bit, unfortunately, but it's a really cool game, and it's accomplishing really impressive stuff for the time. But I think the formula is definitely going to be perfected over the years, because you can feel the age of this game, I think even a little bit more than some arcade games. They have kind of that charm that doesn't age, and they can still be good today, whereas this, I know what new Microsoft Flight Sim looks like, and this just feels behind. But overall, it's still an amazing feat of programming and definitely worth checking out if you're a plane enthusiast.
All right, nice. I almost forgot about this. Like, I saw a video of it at nighttime and I was like, whoa, it's in nighttime.
Yes.
Like, I almost didn't realize that that was a thing. But what do you think about that?
That was pretty cool. And I mean, it basically turns it to black and white, but there's still colors. And, you know, you're navigating by like the lights that are in the distance and stuff. So it's really cool that they have that as an option. And I couldn't find video of it, but I think there is also like afternoon and evening, and I'm not sure how that changes the lighting or what, but it's really cool the amount of options they have.
Nice. Yeah, it's also really cool. You know, I think you kind of mentioned it, but I think this is the longest running video game series ever. Because what other game like have we done before this that is still actively making games? I don't think any.
I couldn't think of any. Like, Ultima's one of the big names. That's why I mentioned that. But that ends in like the early 2000s or something. So I don't know. Yeah.
So I want to say it's like the longest running, obviously not counting like let's say they port Ms. Pac-Man to iOS. Like, I'm not counting, like, I'm talking about games. It's really cool. There's a lot of YouTube videos showing like side-by-side comparisons of Microsoft Flight Simulator 1982 and Microsoft Flight Simulator 2024 and how amazing it looks nowadays. It really kind of puts into perspective like, wow, these two games are like within a lifetime apart, you know, it's like 40 years apart. And just how far we've come is just crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So, I mean, we'll definitely be keeping our eye out on the, you know, future releases of this. And if there's any big changes, I'm sure we'll be revisiting it.
Definitely. But let's get out of the computer games for a little while. Let's move into the ColecoVision. This is like my new favorite piece of hardware, I think.
Yeah.
Again, this is the one that had the Smurfs on it. But this next game that came out in November, it's Mousetrap, and it was a Pac-Man style game. And I keep like scratching my head because it's like they have the most powerful piece of hardware on the market right now, and they're making Pac-Man with it, and it's driving me insane, Wes.
Yeah. But the next thing they did is actually going to be showing, you know, the capabilities of this system. They did Turbo for the ColecoVision, came with a steering wheel peripheral, which is pretty sweet. We didn't end up playing this one because it is basically just Turbo, but it looks pretty dang good too. So love to see them getting some things that we know for having good visuals on the ColecoVision.
Yes, a racing game with fast graphics. That's what they need to do more of.
Oh yeah.
All right, but let's move into a magazine real quick. I don't see too many of these, but this one is the Rainbow Magazine, which is a TRS-80 Coco magazine, the November issue. There was one game of note that I really wanted to mention from this magazine this year, and it was in this issue. It's the game Star Trench Warfare. And what I thought was cool about it, it's a computer game, like a type-in, I think, and it asked you to wear 3D glasses while playing. It's a shooting game with a Star Wars trench type theming, but the 3D glasses are like the classic, like one eyes red, one eyes blue ones, you know?
Right.
So I just thought that was really cool and different. All right, but let's move into my first review of the day. It is a game called Monster Bash by Sega, which came out in November of 1982. This is a ladder climbing Pac-Man type game with a simple shooting mechanic as well. But you know why I picked this one, Wes? It's because it has a horror theming to it, and not the horror as in like they're trying to scare you, which I don't like, but the horror as in like Scooby-Doo horror.
Right.
I love that horror. So there's three levels to the game. One level, it's in Dracula's castle and Dracula's chasing you and you got to defeat him. The other one is in Frankenstein's castle. And then the third level, Wes, can you guess the famous character in this one?
Is it a mummy?
That's right. It's Chameleon Man, your favorite.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Got to have him in that lineup.
I don't know what he's doing here. I tried to look up and see if there was maybe a classic story based on Chameleon Man. Nope. They just made him up for this game. But yeah, so Dracula, Frankenstein, and Chameleon Man. And those are the three levels they repeat if you can go through them all. But so what this game is, you're a dude on screen. You're in Dracula's castle. There's some bats floating around the castle. If they touch you, you die, but you can shoot them with something. I don't know, white line. But you can shoot the bats and scare them off. But there's also Dracula running around the castle. And if he gets you, you die, and he's not really affected by your shots. So to kill Dracula, you have to do something different. What you do is that in every level, there's these candles on screen. There's, I think, 5 candles in the first level, maybe 2 in the second level, and 1 in the third level. And when you activate a candle, it lights up the room and starts like basically a little bit of a countdown timer before the candle flames out, right? So during the time when the candle is active, there's a sword on screen and you can grab the sword when the candle is active and you get like magical powers. Think the Pac-Man pellet, you know, when you're in that phase, if you shoot your main bad guy on screen in the first level, it's Dracula, then you can kill him and that's how you win. So essentially your goal is to run over a candle spot, then get the sword and then fire it at the bad guy. Now, once you get the sword, the bad guy will run away, and if the candle burns out, you can't get the sword again until you reactivate the candle, and the sword only is a power-up that lasts a certain amount of time, not too long. So you have limited time to do it. You usually want to pick up the sword when Dracula's pretty close to you so that you can quickly kill him. Other than that, the screen that you're actually playing on, it's one of these kind of ladders and platforms type levels. You've got like five platforms with different ladders connecting them. There are some doorways that can teleport you to different parts of the level, which is cool. Everything's on one screen, but it just kind of takes you to a different platform. In the second level, it's basically the same thing, but in Frankenstein's castle, instead of bats, he's got these wolves that chase you. And the wolves look, I swear to God, Wes, they look identical to the wolves in, what was the one you did? Puyen.
Puyen. Oh, yeah. Which were kind of terrifying.
Yeah, with the giant like nose and teeth.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe they stole that from Puyen, or if that was just like a common character design back then. I don't know. But they look like identical from that. And I don't know why there would be wolves teaming up with Frankenstein in any case, but it's pretty much the same game. It's just a little harder because there's only, I think, two candles in this. No, I think there's only one candle in this level. There's not as many teleporting doors. And I think the door that is there, you're only able to go through it during certain times. So it's a little bit harder. I think there's more enemies on screen too. Also, probably one of my favorite things actually about this level is that the wolves can duck and like dodge your shot, which is kind of cool. So if you shoot them, you'll usually duck once, and then you just have to shoot again, and then you get them usually, but it's cool that they can kind of juke you. There's also a bit of a weird mechanic where on the edges of the screen, you can kind of like jump off the platform, and if you do that, you can apparently squish the wolves under you, which I never did. But also, Frankenstein can use that to jump down multiple levels really quickly too. So it's a little bit different, but same general vibe. The third stage, however, with Chameleon Man is by far the most different. You're no longer on like a ladders and platforms type level. It's more like a Pac-Man maze on this one. There's three different circles in the maze somewhere where if you walk over it, it changes the color of the maze and also changes the doorways. So imagine there's like different doorways cutting off certain sections of your Pac-Man maze. The doorways, in this case, they're either a green color, a red color, or a blue color. So whenever you walk over this certain spot in the maze that changes the colors, some of those doors will open and some will close. How useful was that? Not really that useful. Personally, it was just like a weird mechanic they had. There's only one candle in this maze and one spot for the sword. And the Chameleon Man and his enemies, or his lackeys, are like these spiders. They were hard, man. They chase you. There's not as much room for you to shoot, because in a Pac-Man style maze, there's not as many like long corridors. Like if you do like five platforms, right, like in the other stages, unless you're on the ladder, you can pretty much shoot anything on your level. But with this case, in an actual Pac-Man style maze, the corridors are not as long, especially in the maze layout they have. So it's harder to hit stuff. And the enemies, they can move faster than you, really. So the third stage, the difficulty went up a lot. And I was never able to beat the third stage. But it's cool, I guess. Chameleon Man's kind of weird. He like sticks his tongue out at you, and his front-facing sprite is really unnerving. Like, it looks like more of like a toad with eyes like on his shoulders. You know what I mean? Like, his eyes are really right. Far apart. So he's pretty weird looking. I don't really know what's going on in the third level. The third level, by the way, is themed that you're playing in a graveyard. So why Chameleon Man would be there anyway, I don't know. But yeah, so those are your three levels, and that's what the gameplay is. Let me get into my ratings. I'll talk a little bit more about it there. Let's start with the gameplay, because I've just been talking about it a bunch. I gave the gameplay a 3.5 out of 10 for Monster Bash. I quite liked it, you know? I mean, we play a lot of these ladder and platform games, so I'm not going to say it's like way different from the other ones, but maybe it's just the theming and what I was doing in it. But I like the fact that you could shoot. I like the fact that you had a goal of collect the candle and the sword. Your character moves slowly, but compared to some other games we've seen, it's not that slow. Like, I could still move at a decent rate. And the screen's not like super huge, or sometimes like in games like this, I feel like it takes forever just to move across the screen. Even in like Donkey Kong, sometimes it takes a while to go from just one edge to the other. didn't really feel that way. To here, there's a lot of ladders, there's a lot of different places you can go, and you had those teleporting doors, which helped a little bit. So I kind of like the gameplay. It's fairly easy until level 3 for whatever reason. That probably helped my enjoyment of it a bit as well. But overall, I thought it was fun. I enjoyed it quite a bit. But now moving into some of my favorite parts about the game. The graphics, I gave a 3.75 out of 10 because I'm just a sucker for this theming, man. What can I say?
Yeah, yeah.
Dracula looks awesome. His bats look cool. The wolves look great. They're straight out of Puyan. Frankenstein looks amazing. Chameleon Man's questionable. But I love the backgrounds. Like, Dracula's castle has these like stained glass windows in the background. Super cool. The candles have like a area of effect of lighting that goes on that slowly kind of goes down over time. Really like that. It's like multiple different like stages to the sprite, right? Probably my least favorite part is your character, who just looks like red and white boy. Like, he's multicolored sprite, but he doesn't really look like anything. You know, he's not very iconic to me. But everything else about the game looks really cool. I love the background colors. It's like mostly purple and Dracula's castle. And Frankenstein is more of like a gray, more like medieval kind of castle. And like I said, the wolves are kind of terrifying. And then you got the graveyard. And that still looks pretty good. So I really like the graphics. If this had different theming, I probably wouldn't really care that much. But I like it. It's definitely up my alley. I forgot to mention too, but the cabinet obviously looks awesome because of the theming. Like, the front bezel is just like, it says Monster Bash, and then it's just a big old portrait of Dracula looking awesome. Nice. So definitely want this one. But then, yeah, so moving on to the sound, I do want to mention in the emulators, it said the sound wasn't emulated properly, or you're not fully completed. So it could have even been better than this, but I was already pretty happy with the sound. I mean, you have like a kind of creepy song that plays in the background at all times. It's a little chromatic, but it's not bad. It's not up too high, you know, pitch-wise. So I thought it was very enjoyable. Reminded me something like out of Bowser's Castle or something. I don't know. So I thought the music was appropriate. It was cool. Didn't get on my nerves. And was two-part harmony at all times. And then you even had some digitized speech where like Dracula and Frankenstein like taunt you. And I was like, yes, that's exactly what I want. And of course, it's like super deep kind of spooky voices.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, it just kind of brought the whole thing together. You get a couple different sound effects and different musical jingles every now and then whenever you do something cool. But just the background music, it made it almost iconic to me. I don't know. It just fit with the rest of the style perfectly. So I was really happy that that was the case. I gave the sound effects a 3.75 out of 10 as well. Relevance, unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be too popular, this one. I don't know why that would be. It was made by Sega, but then again, I feel like Sega has done this before, where sometimes like they'll have like a big game launch and it's like really big, and then sometimes it's like a game just as good and then no one's ever heard of it. I don't know what they're doing over there, but it doesn't seem to be that popular. So I couldn't go too high, but I still liked it. It's still by Sega, so I give it a 4 out of 10 for relevance. Overall, that left me with a 3.75. Definitely an above average game for me, even if it's a little samey, maybe a little safe with its mechanics, you know, things that have already been proven by other games to be good mechanics that just did it, but just with a different theming. But hey, I'm a sucker, so sign me up for Monster Bash any day.
Yeah, I mean, those backgrounds, like you were saying, just look so cool. The graveyard, the castle, and you're messing with Chameleon Man. What more could you want?
Yep.
All right, but that will lead me into my second review of the day, another arcade game called Hanpoko by Sigma. Ponpoco, didn't know, but now I know, is an onomatopoeia for when a tanuki is banging its belly like a drum. And tanuki, for those of you who don't know, in Japan is an sort of like mythical animal or an animal with mystical properties, but it's based on a real animal called the Japanese raccoon dog.
Okay. But
basically, think of like the brown stripy tail power up in Mario or Tom Nook from Animal Crossing. Those are all tanuki inspired characters. The Japanese flyer for this looks great. It's got a bunch of tanuki on a musical staff slapping their bellies. I guess that's why it's called Ponpoco, because they're making the music by slapping their bellies. The marquee just has this super cute red and white tanuki character, along with a snake and a caterpillar with like huge eyes and a gigantic mouth. It reminds me of like the black and white snake lady from Ah Real Monsters or something like that. But getting into the gameplay of Ponpoco, as I said, you play as the tanuki, and the goal is basically to jump over platforms and climb ladders to collect all the fruit or vegetables that are on the stage. So it's another ladder platform kind of game, although this one's much more about the actual platforming and jumping. There are snakes and hairy caterpillars, as the flyer calls them, I think, moving along the screen that kill you if they touch you. They just kind of move horizontally on whatever like platform level they spawn on. There are also baskets that can contain bonus fruit or vegetables, or they could have a snake in them. And if you fall down any of the gaps in the platforms, you also lose the life. And then there's also like thumbtacks just sticking point up on the floor that you have to jump over. So I guess the tanuki's really tiny, or these are really gigantic thumbtacks. And then after collecting all of the fruit or vegetables on the stage, you move to a different stage with a different layout and do it all over again. It's not randomized levels. There's a set sequence to the levels and how they're organized. The snake in the pot is always in the same pot, but it goes on for like a really long time. I think I saw someone who was killing it at the game get like 20 levels in or something like that, and all of them were slightly different. But that's the basic gameplay. There's not really too much more to it. The main thing that you do in this game is jump. You can't attack people. You have to jump over the tacks so you don't hit the tacks. Climb the ladders, jump over the holes in the platforms, pick up all the fruit or vegetables, and avoid the enemies that are moving horizontally across the screen. I'm going to be honest though, Ben, if that sounds like there's not a lot going on in this game, that's because unfortunately that's true. There's not too much going on in this game. It's pretty good, but this is going to be a bit of a negative review.
Oh, no. I will say, you know, Monster Bash didn't have any jumping requirements. I think that was helpful because the jumping usually is not the strong suit of these games.
Yes, and the jumping is weird and floaty. I think part of it is because when your tanuki jumps, he like puts his belly out, his head back, and then puts his head forward in the animation. So even if it functions very similarly to like how Mario jumps in Donkey Kong, it feels weird because he like puts his head back and it looks like he's jumping in this big arc. So yeah, it's a little strange, but let me get into my ratings now for Ponpoco. For graphics, I gave it a 2.75 out of 10. Unfortunately, it really does look like something that could have come out in 1981 instead of 1982. The colors were just kind of flat, and some of the sprites looked really weird. Like the hairy caterpillar, for instance, had this weird flickering texture around the mouth, which I guess was supposed to be the hair on it. But it just looks strange. And apparently these, you know, hairy caterpillars look weird enough that the US release of this didn't understand and called them scorpions instead. The snakes also look a bit strange. They do look like snakes, but their mouth is always open. There's no animation. And there's just like a tongue sticking out. And other than that, they just slide across the screen with no animation.
It's kind of weird too. He slides even when there's no platforms. Like he's just in space. What are they doing?
Yes, they fly over the gaps, and like they, I mean, everything in this time feels on rails. But this, there's like no illusion to it. The caterpillar's just going left to right to left. Like it does kind of break your immersion, I guess, a little bit. I appreciate that all the sprites are multicolored, though. I will say that. But then you get to the background, which is just unfortunately all black. And the map for this, you know, the setting is just blue walls, like bright blue walls and platforms that are little white and blue dots. And it feels like, you know, I'm guessing they did everything they could with the graphics, but it would have fit perfectly if it was like a grassy setting or like you're in a tree on different tree branches, but instead you're just on these like blue dots. It was a little bit weird. The saving grace for this game, though, as far as graphics for me, is definitely the main character, the Tanuki and the fruit. Your character, he's cute, he's rotund, has a big belly, and he does those silly arcing jump animation I talked about where he like throws his head back and then forward. One thing I will say, though, is his ladder climbing sprite is really bad. Like, his one leg is just like, gets extremely long, and it just kind of flips side to side, and I don't know.
You see, Wes, I feel like the ladder climbing is my favorite sprite because it's so weird looking.
That's true. I mean, it is very unique, and I do appreciate they at least drew a little black line on there so you can see his tail from the back. But then there's also a ton of different fruit and vegetable sprites that all look pretty good, I think. And there's a lot of them. Like I said, I think there was like 20 different levels I saw somebody play, and they all had a different fruit or vegetable. And then when you get into the really late game, it looks like instead of fruits or vegetables, the Tanuki finally decides to just collect beer instead. But all of those sprites looked good, so that's why I brought it up a little bit, but there's just some aspects that looked really strange and flickery and weird. Moving on to sounds now, I gave this a 2.75 out of 10 as well. Unfortunately, the sounds aren't incredible in this game either. There's some nice little tunes that play when you get a game over or when you clear a level, but that's the only time they play. And then there's also Jaws music that plays, like the da-da-da-da, when a snake comes out of a pot. But that's kind of it. The jump sound for the Tanuki is really the only thing you're hearing most of the time, and it's this little squeaky trill kind of thing that I did like at first. I mean, it's kind of fun, but when it's the only sound you're hearing over and over again, it got old a little bit fast. Moving on to gameplay now, I hate to be so negative on this, but I gave it a 2.5 out of 10 for gameplay. I just really was not vibing with the Pon Poco gameplay. Jumping over the gaps and collecting the fruit on its own is pretty fun, other than the fact that sometimes you had to walk like all the way through the fruit and almost off a cliff for it to register that you picked it up. I didn't mind jumping over the thumbtacks, I thought that was kind of fun, but the enemies were just super annoying. You can't jump over them, which seems really lame to me because you can't retaliate in any way against them that I saw, so it's just waiting for them to pass and then following them. And that's, you know, it's just like a pattern kind of game in that way where you just have to wait and see which way they're moving, pick up the fruit, and then you make it. You have to climb up the ladder, move on, all that. And there definitely is some strategy to it when you get to the later levels, because you might have to climb up a ladder, then jump over something, climb down the ladder to dodge something, and then go back up to get fruit on the other side. But still, it just didn't feel super fun to me. And the gaps in the platforms also felt a bit weird, because when you fall out of a gap, you fall all the way down to the bottom of the level and die. Even if there's technically another platform below you, it just kind of ignores it visually. Which I guess makes sense because they wanted falling down the platforms to be a death, but it just didn't feel good when you can see your character go straight through a platform. And then when you die, you also have to start the level all the way over again. All the fruit or vegetables that you collected respawn. And I was like, you know, a Pac-Man kind of maze game where, you know, you've already picked up those dots. You don't have to pick up the dots again until you get to the next level. But when every time you die, you just have to start all the way over, it felt kind of like, smashing your head into the wall until you get it. So I wasn't a huge fan of that. But good things about this gameplay, I do think the level variation is really nice. Like I said, there were different like jump sequences, ladder climbing things, and all that for tons of levels into the, you know, you could get like 20 different levels into the game and still it would be different every single time or every single level. I do like that it makes things more complicated with the jumps and where the ladders are and how many enemies there are and how fast they're moving. And it didn't feel super unfair how it made the game more difficult. It was a nice curve, but the gameplay itself just wasn't super engaging for me. Moving on to relevance, though, this also pretty low, only a 3 out of 10, because we couldn't find much info in this game at all. So I don't think it ended up being too popular or too relevant, but it is another video game appearance of a Tanuki, which is always fun. And overall, that left me with a 2.75 out of 10 for Ponpoco. It's got a really cute main character and a fun theme with picking up these fruits and vegetables, but I just felt like it was lacking in a lot of areas for a 1982 game. Sounds were just okay, graphics kind of brought down the charm of the cute character for me. It definitely has some good things for it, but overall, left me feeling a bit sour on it.
All right. Is that a fruit bun that you made there?
You know, unintentionally, but I'm going to roll with that. Okay, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, when I look at this one, I think, wow, Tanuki looks pretty cool. And that's kind of it.
Yeah. That's kind of what it ended up being for me.
The black background hurts so much. I feel very fortunate that Monster Bash had these really nice backgrounds.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry you didn't get that, Wes.
Next time.
We did have two Ponpoco clones. We had one by VentureLine and one by Electron Games. But let's get into the last big game of the day. It's my second review. It's Rescue by Stern. I want to say I was watching a lot of YouTube videos and stuff getting ready for this podcast episode, and a lot of people said that this was a prototype game, but MAME doesn't have it listed as a prototype. They say it was released, and I think the Wikipedia page also says it was released, so I don't know, maybe it just wasn't a wide release, or the YouTubers that I was watching had a prototype version of it, I don't know, but I feel like more than one YouTuber said that, so maybe they were looking at the same source, or I'm not sure what, but this game, man, the graphics on it are insane. That's the main reason why I'm checking it out, but surprisingly, some of the other parts about this game are pretty good too. As far as what you're looking like, or what this game looks like, for Rescue, you play as a helicopter. Your main goal is to save these soldiers that have fallen into the water by picking them up in your helicopter. Basically, when you get close to them, your helicopter has a little ladder that pops out of the bottom of it, and they'll start to climb up the ladder. I think you can get hit during that animation, but after you save however many soldiers that you need to save in order to beat the game, you have to drop them off at an island, and for sure that animation is safe. You're invulnerable when you drop them off. Like, I'm not sure about when you pick them up. I think you're invulnerable. Could be wrong. But yeah, so that's basically the gameplay. Save some guys in the water below you. But what's really cool about the game is the graphics. There's a crazy amount of parallax scrolling going on. I want to say there's something like 7 or 8 layers of parallax scrolling, both above the horizon line and below the horizon line. So that's like 16 layers of parallax scrolling. That's crazy. It's mostly just clouds at the top and like waves at the bottom, with a horizon line with mountains in the distance. One of my favorite things about the game, though, is that there is this crazy gradient of light blue to dark blue. From the bottom of the screen, it's light blue for water, and then it gets darker towards the horizon line, and then right at the horizon line, it's bright blue again for sky, and then that gets darker towards the top of the screen to indicate, like, space, maybe? I don't know. But it just looks really, really good, man. Like,
yeah,
both the parallax scrolling and this shading effect is awesome. The sprites that are involved in this game are crazy tiny compared to like the size of the screen. So they're not that detailed, but the play area feels huge because of that. Both your helicopter and the enemy helicopters that are trying to shoot you, preventing you from saving your guys, they're multicolored sprites. They do have animation. I was really surprised when hitting an enemy helicopter that they have a kind of crash landing animation that's really good. It's got to be at least, I don't know, a couple frames of animation as it kind of tumbles out of the sky, and it can actually hit you as it tumbles out of the sky, killing you, which happened to me many times. But I thought that was a really cool effect. And then it lands into the water with like a little bit of a splash, which I really like. The guys that you're saving, they're kind of like parachute down from the top of the screen. They have at least 2 frames animation there, and then they land in the water. The parachute goes away. You can even start to pick up a guy from the water, and if you try to leave that area too quickly before he's climbed up the ladder, he'll fall off the ladder and back into the water, which is really cool. I mean, I just feel like the animations are great. The graphics are great. Moving on to the other stages now, that's all just in stage one. When we get to stage two, they add a shark enemy in the water that can eat the guys that you're trying to help as well. You can shoot the shark down with your gun, just like usual. I forgot to even mention this, but the game is a two-directional joystick type game, which I really enjoy those type of games too, so that helped this game a lot. So you can shoot and move in all eight directions. The movement's kind of weird, though. It has like a Defender-esque quality to the movement where there's like this really high acceleration on your helicopter. And if you go in one direction more than like a second, your guy just zips across the screen at like uncontrollably fast rates, which I never really liked a Defender that well. And I don't like it here either. I would have preferred just like a more standard like Robotron 2089 kind of movement where it's just a fixed speed that you move. But you have this weird acceleration. The screen does wrap. It's a relatively small wrap, so it's not like Defender where there's, you know, a huge amount of real estate before the screen wraps. It's pretty much like two or three screens wide and then repeats. But anyway, so in the second stage, there's now sharks in the water that you can shoot down. If the sharks eat one of your guys, it's not really a big deal. Like, you don't lose a life based on if people get eaten. So you only lose lives if you get hit. And, you know, if a guy gets eaten, that just means another guy's going to come down from the top. You have to wait for him to get in the water again and then, you know, save him. And the enemies are constantly are respawning whenever you destroy him. So you only have a couple seconds of free time after you destroy the enemy. So basically, if the guy gets eaten, you're going to have to go through those enemies again. But I like the fact that you didn't immediately die if a guy got eaten by a shark. So that was good.
Nice.
Also, I forgot to mention that your character, your helicopter, can actually, if you make contact with the guy as he's parachuting, will kill the guy on the parachute.
Oh, yikes. So
you don't want to run into him. But yeah, that's stage two. In stage three, they add a submarine as a new enemy. The submarine can only be destroyed by a bomb, which is a secondary like fire type from your guy that only fires straight down. It's not very effective, so they save it for just one type of enemy, and the other ones you can just shoot like normal, but your general shooting animation is a lot quicker, so that's good. The bomb's kind of slow and bulky, but luckily there's only one type of enemy that you have to worry about that for, and only on stage three. I think in further stages, more enemies get introduced, like a speedboat, additional helicopters. There is also a like nighttime stage where the screen goes almost completely black except for the waves and the clouds. It doesn't look as good as the daytime fighting, but it's still really cool. So I thought that was awesome too. But yeah, your basic goal, save guys in the water. Every stage, you have to save a different amount of them. It starts with, I think, two, and then the second stage is three. I'm not sure how high it goes up to, but I don't think it's that high. That's pretty much the whole game, but it's a two-directional shooter with some defender elements, with a lot of different types of enemies and the crazy graphics and parallax scrolling. There's also a bonus stage where you just, like, I think 10 people, like, parachute in. You just save as many as you can in, like, a minute or something. I don't know. It wasn't that impactful. But yeah, that's pretty much it. Let me get into my ratings for this. Let's start off with the gameplay for this one. I gave the gameplay for Rescue a 3.75 out of 10. I think it's quite good. I was a little unsure, you know, the graphics really pull your eye to this one, and then you're like, well, is the gameplay really good? I think the gameplay was pretty good. It's a little samey because all you do is pick up people and put them on an island, but the enemy variety really helped a lot. I thought the enemy helicopters, not only were they fun to play around with, I liked that you had to dodge their burning vehicles as they went to the ocean after you hit them. Yeah. That was a cool effect. The fact that you have to watch out for the sharks down below and the submarines and stuff later was also really cool. And the fact that you've got multiple different firing buttons that you can fire and move in any direction at the same time, because it's a two-directional shooter, really cool. And there's just a lot of like little connective tissue things with the animations that help make the gameplay feel really smooth. The frame rate was really good. It felt fast. You can fire at least two bullets on screen at a time. So I liked it. It was a really good game. For the sound effects, I gave that a 3.25 out of 10. There's not really any music to this game, but there is a constant helicopter blade sound that plays that's a little choppy. But I kind of liked it. I think it fit the game really well. You do have more generic shooting sounds and even maybe some spacey sounds that aren't like super good. But the overall package just kind of felt right for the game and a little bit different from most other shooting games that we play. So I liked it. There's even a nice sound for when your guy climbs up the ladder into the helicopter that I liked a lot. It wasn't like my favorite part about the game, but it was good enough. And you do have a couple musical jingles in between the levels too, so it helps. But let's get to the big one for graphics. I want to preface this by saying, you know, when I look at emulation of this game, it almost feels too good to be true. Because especially the faded colors, you really can't tell. It's not like bands of color slowly fading between a light blue and a dark blue. Like it looks like one solid fade from light blue to dark blue. And I've never really seen that before other than in the hand-painted backgrounds that we've done. But there is good YouTube videos of actual cabinets of this game. So I checked it out. And I will say, like, if you watch videos of the actual cabinet, it doesn't look as good as the emulation does. Mm. But I don't think it's because of the game's fault. I think it's actually the fault of old CRT TVs, which is what this played on. Because at this level of detail, you can see like the individual strips of CRT TV, like pixels, that's the scale they're playing with. I mean, I looked up, you know, what is the typical resolution for CRT monitors in 1982? And it's like the same resolution as this game played. So it was using the full capacity that TVs could display at the time. And I think if they had a LCD monitor, it would have looked pretty much like it what does in, you know, the emulation today, but it doesn't quite look that way. I don't think I should hold it against it, though. You still do see that fade of blue that is somehow just like way better than everything we've seen before. You still see the parallax scrolling. It just looks a little bit more pixelated in the older videos. But again, I don't think that's fault of the game. Honestly, I was kind of blown away with the graphics of this, just how everything moved, how it felt, how fast the frame rate was, the colors, the animations. You know, I've been holding off giving anything above like a 5, you know, I feel like in the timeline, because I felt like for a game to get that high of a score, it really needs to deserve it. I think it deserves it. I'm giving this a 5 out of 10.
Oh, he's going to do it.
5 out of 10 for the graphics, Wes.
Nice.
I don't know. I just felt, yeah, this is like, there's games made today that don't look like this, like as good as this. And, you know, with a little bit of a caveat, that's for if you play it on a modern LCD monitor, which is what I'm doing, or, you know, a 2025 monitor. But I don't think it looks that good if you were to play it in real life on the arcade machine. But still, it's one of a kind. And I think it really does take it to the next level. So if you don't know about this one, please check it out. It's truly one of the best we've seen, I think. So, and I don't think it's cheating. I don't think the emulation's cheating, or that it came out, you know, it really came out in 83 or something. Like, I think it's just that good.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, it could also be the camera that recorded the real life arcade cabinet footage as well. If that has a different refresh rate than the screen that is recording, it can also make the screen look worse. So it just means we'll have to find one in person sometime, Ben.
I would love that. Well, let me get into my relevance, because unfortunately they do seem somewhat rare. I mean, I have seen a couple videos of people have that had real cabinets, so I know that they're still out there. It definitely has a fan base, so that's good. But I don't think it sold all that well for Stern. I end up giving the relevance a 6 out of 10 just because of the graphical improvements that it made to all the video games, you know, compared to all of its peers. But unfortunately, you know, gameplay-wise, it is unique, but it didn't really change much or do anything that innovative with the gameplay. And like I said, I don't think it sold all that well, so I'm just giving it a 6 out of 10 for relevance. Overall, that left me with a 4 out of 10, which feels low now, but a 4 out of 10 is a great score.
Yeah.
But yeah, the graphics, I think, are kind of unmatched in 1982 right now. The gameplay is fairly solid, I think. And the sound effects are not the best, but they're not terrible either. So overall, it lends me with probably one of my favorite ones I've done so far or in the last few months, I think. It kind of surprised me how good the gameplay was for this. I wasn't expecting that. I knew it looked good, but I thought that might be all it could do. But right. I actually really liked it.
Oh, that's awesome, man. I mean, talk about hidden gems. That's one that I've never heard of before. That's one most people probably wouldn't think, maybe because of its rarity as well. But always love to see when a game that catches our eye for something, this, you know, the graphics, that's not the only thing it's got. It's got more. It's got a whole game there that's really good. So awesome. All right, and we did have a couple bootlegs of Rescue. We had Rescue by Free Enterprise Games, and then Tuono Blue, if I'm saying that right, by Videl Games.
All right, and with that, we will end it for today. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. We talked about a new computer, the Sword M5, and we didn't end up actually reviewing any of those games, but I'm sure we will in the future. A lot of them were just arcade ports, to be fair. But then we did do Microsoft Flight Simulator version 1.0. Such a landmark game, and I'm just looking forward to version 2.0. Wes, it's just going to be twice as good, right? But we also have Monster Bash, which I really liked a lot. It had great graphics and a really cool theme that is right up my alley. Wes, you did Pon Poco, which wasn't the best, but it had a cool Tanuki guy in it. And then I did Rescue by Stern, which the graphics were just insane, but it also had pretty good gameplay and decent sound effects too. So just a great full package there, but maybe the new benchmark for graphics for me anyway.
All right. Yeah. Well, always, you know, love to see games like that are setting us to new heights, and they're what we're going to be comparing things to in the future. So make sure to keep listening. If you guys enjoy what we're doing here, covering all the games that we can find in the history of video games, we've got a great website where we have tons of good information on things we've covered before. You can also follow us on X, where we post announcements about our episodes. And if you have any questions at all, feel free to send us an email.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.